Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, September 25th, 2020. Here are some of your headlines. The late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg makes history as the first woman to lie in state in the U.S. Capitol building, performing at the memorial service one of her favorite opera singers. A long-running legal fight over a subpoena for President Trump's tax returns back in federal court. President's attorney arguing the Manhattan District Attorney's subpoena is overbroad and issued in bad faith. We'll talk to a reporter with the New York Daily News. On the presidential campaign trail, President Trump meeting with Latino leaders in Florida and referencing his pledge to build a southern border wall, saying, "I'm like a wall between the American dream and chaos and a horror show." While Democratic vice presidential nominee Kamala Harris speaks at the NAACP National Convention, held online this year due to the coronavirus pandemic. And Virginia Governor Ralph Northam and First Lady Pamela Northam have tested positive for coronavirus, plan to isolate for 10 days to monitor their symptoms per state health guidelines. Northam is the third governor to test positive. The others are Missouri's Mike Parson and Oklahoma's Kevin Stitt.
Face. Forward, march.
Forward.
Eight military pallbearers carrying Ruth Bader Ginsburg's flag-draped casket up the U.S. Capitol steps into Statuary Hall. Congressional leaders and guests stood in somber observance. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi opened the ceremony.
It is with profound sorrow and deep sympathy to the Ginsburg family that I have the high honor to welcome Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg to lie in state in the Capitol of the United States. She does so on a catafalque built for Abraham Lincoln. May she rest in peace.
And that was in 1865. That catafalque has been used for everyone who has lied in state in the U.S. Capitol, some in the Rotunda, some in National Statuary Hall. After Speaker Pelosi's remarks, Rabbi Lauren Holtzblatt of Addis Israel Congregation in Washington, the synagogue the Ginsburgs attended, spoke of how Ruth Bader Ginsburg reached a seat on the highest court in the country despite the obstacles she faced as a woman in the legal profession.
Pursuing justice took resilience, persistence, a commitment to never stop. As a lawyer, she won equality for women and men, not in one swift victory, but brick by brick, case by case, through meticulous, careful lawyering. She changed the course of American law. And even when her views did not prevail, she still fought. In recent years, Justice Ginsburg became famous for her dissents. Despair was not an option. She said, and I quote, "Dissents speak to a future age. It's not simply to say my colleagues are wrong and I would do it this way. But the greatest dissents do become court opinions, and gradually, over time, their views become the dominant view, so that the dissenters hope that they are writing not for today, but for tomorrow. Justice Ginsburg's dissents were not cries of defeat. They were blueprints for the future." Justice Ginsburg loved her family, her grandchildren, her dear friends, her colleagues, and her court family. We all send our love to you. And Justice Ginsburg also loved the court to which she so devoted her life. A court for all of us. It was Justice Ginsburg's tenacious hope to preserve the integrity of the court. Today, she makes history again as the first woman and the first Jewish woman to lie in state. Today we stand in sorrow, and tomorrow we, the people, must carry on Justice Ginsburg's legacy. Even as our hearts are breaking, we must rise with her strength and move forward. She was our prophet, our North Star, our strength for so very long. Now she must be permitted to rest after toiling so hard for every single one of us. May the memory of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Yita Rucho Batziro Leah, forever and ever be a blessing. Zichrona Livracha. God, give us the strength and bless us with the courage, the intelligence, the bravery, and the unbreakable resolve to pursue justice. Amen.
Rabbi Lauren Holtzblatt, whose husband, by the way, clerked for Justice Ginsburg from 2014 to 2015. Ginsburg was known as a big fan of opera, and performing at today's ceremony, mezzo-soprano Denise Graves. This selection is American Anthem. Denise Graves. Among those paying respects today, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden and vice presidential nominee Senator Kamala Harris. And also Justice Ginsburg's personal trainer, Brian Johnson, who approached the casket, dropped to his knees, and did 3 push-ups. Justice Ginsburg will be buried next week at Arlington National Cemetery. And the New York Times writing today, Justice Ginsburg was to lie in the National Statuary Hall on the House side of the Capitol, where Democrats are in control. Many dignitaries have lain in state in the Capitol rotunda between the House and the Senate, but both chambers must agree and pass special legislation to allow it. President Donald Trump has scheduled a news conference on Saturday at 5 p.m. Eastern to announce his selection of a nominee to fill the vacancy on the Supreme Court. You can listen to that news conference live here on C-SPAN Radio. We'll also be opening up our phone lines and getting your reaction after that Saturday, 5 p.m. Eastern. This is Washington Today. President Trump campaigned in 3 states this Friday, Florida, Georgia, and Virginia. First, a roundtable in Doral, Florida, focusing on Latino issues. He made the case he's the better candidate for the Hispanic community than Democratic nominee Joe Biden on the economy, school choice, safety, among other topics. At one point, the president used an analogy that referenced another of his campaign promises.
Many Latino and Hispanic Americans came here to pursue the American dream, having left countries that they just felt was very, very unsafe. And, you know, it's a very similar ideology, okay? If you look at Venezuela, you look at what's going on there, and you'll see some interesting things happening. You look at that and you look at what's going on in other countries. Some of you are from those other countries and you got lucky to get out. But it's the same kind of thing that you'd see happen here. I'll tell you what, I'm like a wall. You know, we're building a wall on the southern border. It's almost complete. But I'm like a wall between the American dream. I'll say this because it sounds nice, but it's true. I think Max would agree with it. Between the American dream, I'm a wall. Between the American dream and chaos and a horror show. It would be very bad. It would be very bad. Many Latino and Hispanic Americans came here to pursue the American dream, having left countries that really had a very, very unruly group of people. You know, we're throwing out MS-13 all the time. The only one's not afraid is that guy right there. He wouldn't be afraid of MS-13. He's the only guy in the room. But they're rough. They're bad. And they're bad people. He's a great person. They're bad people. And we throw thousands and thousands out of our country. And if we didn't have ICE and these people, they would be living in real fear and real problems. And, you know, the funny thing about the southern border, the wall, safety, The people that understand the border better than anybody are the Hispanics. I have had more support when we build the wall, because they don't want bad people coming into our country. They don't want people coming into the country that are going to take their jobs. And they understand it better. And I always thought it would be the opposite in a way. They understand what we've done on the border. We have stopped it. And you can come into the country, but you have to come in legally. It's an incredible thing that's taken place over the last year.
President Donald Trump in southern Florida in Doral. The Orlando Sun-Sentinel reporting an average 10 public opinion polls of Florida voters released this month that break out the results for Hispanic voters shows Joe Biden with 50% and Donald Trump with 43%. Among all voters, those same polls show a 3-point lead for Biden. Also today, billionaire and former Democratic presidential candidate Michael Bloomberg announcing his plans to blitz the Florida airwaves with a $40 million TV ad buy, the first since he pledged to spend $100 million in Florida, a crucial battleground state, to defeat President Trump. Senator Kamala Harris, the Democratic vice presidential nominee, taking part today in the 111th NAACP National Convention. It was held virtually due to the coronavirus pandemic. At one point, she was asked about the shooting death case of Breonna Taylor and the announcement this week that none of the police officers involved will be directly charged in that death.
How did you feel as a Black woman hearing about the charges in the Breonna Taylor case or the lack thereof?
It was a gut punch in many ways. I have been in conversations with her mother, Tamika Palmer, for months now, you know, and the first conversation that I had with her when she talked about her daughter and therefore the life that has now been lost. Breonna Taylor was a caregiver in her spirit and her nature. She cared for her grandmother. She cared for her family. She cared for her community. She cared for society. She cared for people she had never met, which is why she wanted to be, as her life dream, a nurse, but decided to first become an EMT so she could respond to the call on the street, so that she would understand what was happening in the streets, on the ground, and be able to respond immediately. That's why she became an EMT with a life's purpose and dream of becoming a nurse. And she was beautiful inside and out in every way. And it is tragic. And, you know, I have been saying from the beginning that her life deserves to be valued and to be honored. And she and her family and the rest of the community deserve justice. Deserve justice then, they deserve justice today, and they deserve justice tomorrow. And, you know, it's now become cliche, but it just remains true. I will not stop speaking her name.
Senator Kamala Harris, Democratic vice presidential nominee at today's NAACP National Convention. In Louisville, Kentucky, the first statement from the family and the attorney of Breonna Taylor. Bianca Austin is Breonna's aunt, and she said a statement on behalf of her sister, Breonna's mother, Tamika Palmer.
Most of you know this has been emotionally, mentally and physically draining for my sister, so I'm gonna do the honor and read her thoughts after Daniel Cameron's decision. And I quote, "I never had faith in Daniel Cameron to begin with.
Amen.
I knew he was too inexperienced to deal with a job of this caliber. I knew he had already chosen to be on the wrong side of the law. The moment he wanted the grand jury to make the decision, what I had hoped is that he knew he had the power to do the right thing, that he had the power to start the healing of this city, that he had the power to help men over 400 years of oppression. What he helped me realize is that it will always be us against them, that we are never safe when it comes to them. Mattingly, in an email, called us animals and thugs. It's clear that that is the way that they will always see us. I was reassured Wednesday of why I have no faith in the legal system, in the police, in the law that are not made to protect us Black and brown people. But when I speak on it, I'm considered an angry Black woman. Mm. But know this, I am an angry Black woman.
That's right.
I am not angry for the reasons that you would like me to be.
That's right.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Angry because our Black women keep dying at the hands of police officers.
Black men.
Okay. Angry because our children are dying at the hands of police officers. And I'm angry because this nation is learning that our Black women dying at the hands of police officers, and this is not okay. You can take the dog out of the fight, but you can't take the fight out of the dog.
Say it again.
For lack of better terms, bark, bark for being the dog still standing to fight.
Yeah.
Bianca Austin in Jefferson Square Park in Louisville, Kentucky. Protests continue in the city. Police arrested at least 24 people Thursday night, including a state representative who sponsored Brianna's law to end no-knock warrants in the state. Two police officers were shot and injured this week. And Ben Crump, one of the attorneys for the Taylor family, now calling on the Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron to release the transcripts of the grand jury proceedings that led to this week's decision to charge only one of the three officers in the case. Back in a minute with more Washington Today. And welcome back to Washington Today. A few other headlines. The New York Times reporting Attorney General William Barr briefed President Trump this week on the details of an ongoing Justice Department voter fraud investigation, according to a department official. A highly unusual move that raised new questions about any role the department has in Mr. Trump's reelection bid. Mr. Barr told the president that federal investigators in Pennsylvania were examining whether local election officials had discarded 9 mail-in votes, at least 7 of which that were cast for Mr. Trump, the official said. After he was briefed, Mr. Trump publicly referenced the discarded ballots in a radio interview on Thursday. And the U.S. House of Representatives will be voting next week on a resolution supporting a peaceful transfer of power after President Trump this week declined to commit to it if he loses re-election. Senate passed a similar resolution by unanimous consent on Thursday. Russian President Vladimir Putin proposing an agreement with the U.S. to avoid interfering in each other's elections and other domestic affairs. Putin citing what he called the risk of large-scale confrontation in the digital sphere. And former President Barack Obama endorsing a candidate in Georgia's special U.S. Senate election. It's Democrat Reverend Raphael Warnock, who's in a tight race against several other Democrats and Republicans. If no candidate gets 50% on November 3rd, there's going to be a runoff election. This from Reuters. A lawyer for Donald Trump on Friday faced skeptical questions from a federal appeals court considering whether to let Manhattan's top prosecutor obtain the president's tax returns in connection with a criminal probe into Trump and his businesses. William Consovoy, Trump's lawyer, telling the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Manhattan the subpoena from Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance for the tax returns was overbroad and issued in bad faith to harass him. Here's a portion of the oral argument, Consovoy being questioned by Judge Raymond Loyer.
If we were to limit the subpoena to tax returns that are for domestic transactions, between 2011 and 2016, would that be something that you could live with?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Why not? You just told us that a big part of the problem with respect to the overbreath issue is that it asks for statements, documents, and so on all around the world. And I'm offering a possible solution of tax returns for a limited period of time, well narrower than the 9-year period, so we're talking about 4 or 5 years, and all domestically based.
I understand, Your Honor. I think, again, that would be far narrower. There's no question. It's far less overbroad. I don't disagree, and I understand where Your Honor's coming from. And of course, Your Honor, sitting aside the issue of bad faith would still need.
I'm just focused on overbreath.
Right. Yep. And so the question becomes, when you say domestically, of course, that encompasses numerous enterprises that I think are far beyond anything the district attorney could be investigating. I just give you one example, and I use this one because I just think it's the most obvious. That subpoena that he copied included, you know, I assume returns for the hotel in Washington, which was potentially or purportedly being investigated for federal lease issues in Washington, D.C. I still think it's overbroad to include those kinds of entities.
Is there a request for documents in this case? Let's assume that we're just talking about the Cohen. Is there a request for documents that would not, in your view, be overbroad?
Well, I have to know. I think the answer is probably no, Your Honor, and here's why. We just go back.
That's the problem. Don't you see the problem?
I see why you're concerned. I'd like to try to assuage those concerns. So we go back to the basis for the investigation, which, at least as alleged, is the Cohen payments. The district attorney served as a broad subpoena on the Trump Organization, very broad, concerning those events, a narrow event, but a broad subpoena in terms of encompassing that event. The Trump subpoena didn't mitigate that, the Trump Organization. It began to comply. It was at that point that the district attorney said, well, we also like the tax returns. And there was a two-prong, really, dispute there. One, whether it was encompassed, but two, whether they were even relevant to the dispute. Now, if a court were to determine they are relevant, then that would be one thing. But it has to be reasonably related.
William Consovoy, lawyer for President Trump and a federal appeals court judge, Raymond Loyer, during today's oral argument in the continuing case, Trump v. Vance. And joining us now with more on this case is Stephen Rex Brown, federal courts reporter with the New York Daily News. Mr. Brown, can you explain what happened in today's argument?
Well, sure. What we heard today was the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in Lower Manhattan seemingly signaling that they have run out of patience with Trump's challenges to subpoenas for his financial records from Manhattan DA Cy Vance. I've covered this case since it was filed last year, since Trump sued to block enforcement of the subpoenas on his longtime accounting firm, Mazars. And every step of the way, he has gotten the deference from the courts that you would expect for the President of the United States. What happened here, it seemed like, was a very notable shift in tone. You heard Judge Loyer asking if there were any scenario where these subpoenas would not be overbroad, and Trump attorney William Consovoy said no. The judge says, that's a problem. You see why that's a problem. And I believe that is the judge signaling a new level of skepticism, and the judge's colleagues on the three-judge panel also echoed that skepticism.
If the court rules against the president, this case has already been to the Supreme Court once. Is it heading back there again?
It certainly could wind up in the Supreme Court again. And obviously the dynamics of the Supreme Court have shifted now that there's only 8 judges on the court with the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The one sort of variable that I think is worth keeping an eye on is Judge Pierre LaValle, or I'm sorry, not Judge Pierre LaValle, Judge Loyer, asked Vance's attorney, Kerry Dunn, why he was waiting and holding off on enforcing the subpoena. And that judge seemed open to the possibility that Vance could just go ahead, demand the records from Mazars, and get Trump's tax returns. If Vance determines that he can do that, and he does do that, that would really change the calculus for Trump, change the calculus for the Supreme Court on whether it would consider the case, and could really be a curveball that changes the dynamics of this year-long fight.
Remind our listeners again, why was this subpoena issued in the first place? Who was seeking what records and for what purpose?
When the subpoenas first emerged, Vance was understood to be investigating how the Trump Organization accounted for hush money payments made to women during the lead up to the 2016 presidential election. since then, as this legal fight has made its way through the courts, it's appeared that the probe has expanded, and it's expanded to include other possible insurance and bank fraud and other financial crimes. It's very vague exactly what Vance is looking at, but it does seem clear, and Vance's attorney, Kerry Dunn, acknowledged that the investigation has broadened through this grand jury investigation.
And finally, if you had to guess, will the subpoena succeed? Will the records have to be released? And if so, when?
If I had to guess, and I'm not in the prediction business, but I would say the courts tend to move slow. Though the Second Circuit Court of Appeals signaled it was running out of patience, Trump's strategy of delay, I think it's fair to call it that, has worked up to this point. He still has the Supreme Court, and I think, and then there's grand jury secrecy rules protecting the evidence in that investigation, which would presumably be the Trump's tax returns if Vance gets them. So if we were ever going to see the tax returns, they would only come out if Vance brought a criminal case and the case went to trial. So I would not hold your breath on these documents emerging before the election.
Stephen Rex Brown covers the federal courts for the New York Daily News. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Also today, a federal appeals court in Washington, D.C., reviving a lawsuit by House Democrats challenging the Trump administration's authority to use military funds for a border wall. 3-0 decision. The appeals court reversed a lower court's dismissal of the case, and that means the House has the right to sue, and the case is going to be sent back to the trial court level. On Wall Street today, the Dow is up 358, NASDAQ up 241, S&P up 51. An update on the coronavirus pandemic. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis says he is lifting all restrictions on businesses statewide that were imposed to control the spread. And that means restaurants and bars in the state can now operate at full capacity. The governor was in St. Petersburg.
We are today moving into what we initially called phase three. And what that'll mean for the restaurants is that there will not be limitations from the state of Florida. And in fact, we're also cognizant about the need for business certainty. There have been some local closures and other types of restrictions. And so the order that I'm signing today will guarantee restaurants operate, will not allow closures. They can operate at a minimum of 50% regardless of local rule. And then if a local restricts between 50 and 100, they've got to provide the justification and they've got to identify what the costs are involved with doing that are. And I think that that's important. This is a very difficult industry to succeed in. The margins aren't great. And if you go back to March, we were told 15 days to slow the spread. So that was, and in Florida, we followed that. It was no dining restaurants, the bars, the gyms, no elective procedures, some of these things. And then they said, well, you know what, we need another 30 days. So 30 days to slow the spread. So we did that as well. And yet you have some people say, well, you can never do, full what you want to do until there's a vaccine. Well, we don't know, hopefully. But now people are saying, hey, even if there's a vaccine, it's still going to take another year before you can operate appropriately. And, I don't think that's viable. I don't think that that is acceptable. And so I think that this will be very, very important to the industry. And it also will be a recognition that they have worked as hard as anybody to create safe environments. In fact, the idea that government dictating this is better than them making these decisions so that their customers have confidence, I think is misplaced. And I've gone to many restaurants over the last many months, and they take this obligation seriously. They want customers to have confidence, and so they have every incentive to want to do that going forward.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in St. Petersburg. He also banned local jurisdictions from fining people who refuse to wear masks. Today, the United States passed 7 million confirmed coronavirus cases, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. and there have been over 200,000 deaths. Finally, a view of the coronavirus pandemic from Jane Goodall, scientist and conservationist, best known for her decades of studying chimpanzees. She was a guest speaker at the National Press Club today.
We've destroyed environments, habitats, pushed animals in closer contact with people, given an opportunity for a pathogen such as the COVID-19 virus to jump from an animal to a person and maybe start a new disease. We've hunted them, killed them, eaten them. We've trafficked them. We've sent them from different regions or different countries to be sold as food, medicine, or as pets in the wildlife markets of Asia. We've sold them as food or sometimes medicine in the bushmeat markets of Africa. And also there is the exotic pet trade, usually illegal, which is now a global business worth billions of dollars. And in all these situations, as well as in our factory farms, where animals are kept, billions of them, in crowded, unsanitary conditions, these are creating the environment for creating a new zoonotic disease. And unfortunately for us, COVID-19 is extremely contagious and has spread around the world and has affected every country, I would say every country. It's caused so much suffering and hardship, loss of life, disruption of the economy. And then when you think that it's the same disrespect of the natural world, the same feeling that we can have unlimited global economic development on a planet with finite natural resources.
Jane Goodall, National Press Club event held virtually. Thanks for joining us on Washington Today. Download the free C-SPAN radio app to listen anywhere and get our podcasts available wherever you get your podcasts or at cspan.org/podcasts. Have a good night and weekend. We'll see you next week.